we think that what we want is just things to be more efficient, more fast, so we could get to our destinations faster. But like, it's just, that's not what life is about, actually.
No, you're spot on. And the reason, like, again, just to bring this full circle, incorporating all of what we've spoken about, the reason we have that perspective is because we're anomalous, and that resulted in the desacralization of everyday life. Before, you wouldn't you would have recognized that there was something sacred in the local community, in what you had, and there not being traffic. And so you would never think to impede it. But because it's been desacralized, well, the only logical answer basically is, well, of course, dude, because why would you not be more efficient? You don't even stop to ask the question. That's the whole thing. That's how
you order a report from Deloitte, who work out all the financial, environmental and social impacts of building a bridge. And they create nice little tables and graphs and reports and have scientists sign it all off. And they say, oh, yeah, everything's great. Let's just go ahead and do it, basically. Yeah. Right. And there'll be a couple of people down there, these old people in this little town who are dissatisfied. And like, yeah, we'll give them some money and then they'll be happy.
Yeah. Like, no, it's because everything's been desacralized. There are things in life more important than money.
Jordan Peterson has called for a need to rediscover the spirit of the Father. Many have been inspired to embark on their own hero's journey to set their life in order. But how do we balance order and chaos to live a life of meaning? What does it actually mean to be surrendered to God? And how do we root ourselves to stable ground as we witness the re-enchantment of reality? At Manifesto, we're engaged on a mission to rediscover and understand manhood, and from this foundation to create a dynamic and thriving community. My name's Paul. Welcome to Manifesto. Evan, good to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Paul. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so we've been in touch a couple of times over the last couple of weeks because we realized that I found a guy who's doing something similar to me living here in Europe and speaking the English language, and I'm very excited about that. You have a website called Rewire the West. I think I'll just introduce it quickly for everybody. What I love the most is I get an email from you every single week on Saturdays, which has an artwork, it has some kind of piece of literature, and then there's some kind of music, often a link to a beautiful classical musical piece that I pretty much always just put on when I get the email in from you, and then sit and continue to do whatever it is I'm doing while I have this music going in the background. And you write really beautifully and inspiringly about a lot of these topics as well. So happy to have you on here.
Pleasure.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, what we agreed to start off with is that that's what I really saw that you're doing that I really appreciate is you're working with this idea. Sorry, this is my phone ringing of beauty, which seems to have been like, you know, our devastated culture, everything's being flattened. Then I'm saying that you're kind of like trying to raise something up again as well. So would you like to give us a bit of a background of like why you decided to do that and what the whole kind of mission and ethos is behind Rewire the West?
Sure thing. Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear that the emails, you've been enjoying those. That is always a positive. I do try to write quite lovingly about the works that are included in that. And, you know, the whole point is of both the emails and the channel is to introduce people to good art that has the potential to really change people's lives. Now, the reason I go that route is because, and if I can here, I'll actually use an analogy that I was speaking with a mutual friend of ours. Thank you, introduced me to him, Will of Ren of Men, the Renaissance of Men. Mm-hmm. And last night we were speaking about this, and he mentioned this one Bruce Lee movie. I forget which it was, but basically the teacher teaches Bruce, you know, he points to heaven and he says, all right, don't look at the finger because you'll miss what it's pointing at. And the whole point of this, if I can wrap this into analogy, is that good art points us to higher things. Beauty points us to truth, to virtue. It helps us get through tough times. It points us to the heaven of where we want to get, a life full of meaning, fulfillment. That is the role of art. And so in anything that I'm doing, you know, on the channel or the emails, I'm trying to, in whatever degree I can, inspire young men in particular to pursue these things. because I think in our culture today, they've gone by the wayside. Mm-hmm. They've either been completely destroyed in the sense of, you know, relativism, nominalism, and saying that, oh, well, everything's completely relative and there's no inherent beauty. They've either been destroyed in that aspect, or they've been caricatured to come off as a what's the best way of saying it? Kind of an over intellectual pursuit that doesn't have, you know, meaning to the working class man. Mm-hmm. And I would say, well, actually quite the opposite. Beauty at its best helps everyday people, you and me, get through the tough moments of life, and it enriches our life. And we need it, pure and simple. And so again, it's the finger that points at the heavens that helps us get to where we want to go. And that was the reason behind me starting the channel, the website, and these emails. Is what I'm hoping to do is just to, you know, help people. I'm pointing to the finger that's pointing to heaven, and that's all I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, and I guess this is certainly a journey that I've been through myself. I think what for a lot of people, like what kind of grow up with, you know, maybe from our childhood, we have some idea of beauty and have some experiences that are powerful. And then we kind of go through the system and get trained and kind mm-hmm. of get shut down more and more. And certainly, you know, I had a university education, which was very much grounded in postmodernism, which kind of like dulled or just jaded my senses for a lot of these things. And so there came a point in my life where I realized that, you know, the problems with this kind of like flattening of everything like that. And I realized, well, there needs to be something that I can look upwards towards. And, you know, you can use this thing, that word heaven as well, right? Yeah. And in the beginning as well, then it was hard to figure out for me how to find that again. And the last place I wanted to look at, that was in the classics and the old stuff, right? Because that was all about just like, you know, the dark ages and oppression and like bad tyrannical patriarchs and stuff like that. So it's kind of like a double realization.
Is that like thoughts that you had, or is that what, you know, your school had taught you to believe?
I think I can see the roots of it certainly in my school education. Absolutely. That like when we studied history in school and South African history, it was very much just like, this is what happened, boom, 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 which has some value to it as well, I think. I don't think we should completely write that off as well. But it was very much based on a kind of like criticism of like, you know, we're much more enlightened now. So it was this enlightenment perspective that like today we understand everything much better. And those people back then, they were kind of like, you know, uncouth and rough barbarian people, and they didn't really understand reality. And especially, you know, the criticism throughout there, that was definitely like the rational human being, the individualist, the humanist project, seen as the center of everything. And this kind of also like the, you know, kind of modernist progress narrative, that everything's better today than it was back then, right?
Yeah.
Which then of course is very vulnerable to that postmodern kind of attack. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to hear even is, would you mind, I don't know, what was your background for kind of these realizations, and did you go through a similar journey?
Yeah. So I actually kind of like to kick my journey off with the Beatles in high school, which is essentially, I had gotten to this point, you know, I was into music and whatnot, played in a band. And at one point, maybe it was sophomore year of high school, I had, for whatever reason, hadn't really spent a lot of time listening to the Beatles, like getting to know their catalog. And I kept on hearing people referencing them and referencing this song or that song, or this album or that album. And at one point I just said, enough. I need to go to the source. And so I started buying all their albums, started listening to them. And really what that taught me was, not only, you know, did it make me appreciate their music much more, but what it taught me more importantly was the importance of just going to the source. Like, stop reading a book about a person, stop listening to a lecture about this thing, stop listening to people tell you why this is important. Just go and read the darn thing, go and listen to the darn thing, go and observe the darn thing. Like, that is what it taught me. And so basically that undergirding idea or concept, if you will, carried me through college and university, and again, kind of being an environment similar to the one that you were in, this narrative of, oh, progress and everything today is better. And oh, how silly were those people to, you know, see spirituality and everything, or to believe in God, or we're so much better than that. Ha ha ha. And I started to think, like, man, you know, it was actually, I'll put a quick cliff note here. It was actually, I was reading a lot of nonfiction at the time. Like university, I almost read exclusively nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, based on what I had been learning, what would these other
what
works
were you studying at university?
Me? Excuse me?
What were you studying at university?
I actually did music business, of all things. Okay, wow. It was kind of a liberal arts college, so I was able to study a couple of different things. But mainly, you know, business and whatnot. And the one literature class I had, the lady was an avowed communist, and just really, she only talked about Hegel's master-slave dialectic, and it was just awful. But anyways, all that to say, I was reading a lot of nonfiction at the time, and I didn't see the value that fiction had. But eventually, it just got to be not only just surface level, but there is no substance to feast on which the soul could feast, really. I don't have a ton of ways to describe it, but basically just consuming the stuff that, all right, like, it's knowledge that's great, but it doesn't transform your life. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know what, let me go back to something that has substance, that's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, I actually began with Shakespeare, one of his comedies of all places. But in this comedy, which is now one of my favorite plays, Much Ado About Nothing, I found just beautiful joy of life in an incredible interior richness that I hadn't found anywhere else. And that kickstarted, you know, a mission to go and explore the classics, to explore the works that have been around for hundreds of years, that have stood the test of time for a reason. And I think that is the biggest thing. If you understand that these works, they aren't just around because someone decided one day to include them in the pantheon of Western literature. No, it's not that. It's the fact that they have stayed around for hundreds of years, if not thousands, because they resonate with people on the truest levels of what it means to be a human, and on the truest levels of the human experience. And so for that reason, if none other, that's, you know, why I personally turned to literature, why I began to go this route in my own life, and why I was so moved by it, that I decided that I wanted to start to share it with others.
Great. Yeah, and going to the source, that's what you started with, and I really appreciate that. It made me think of when I was a teenager, then everybody in my class watched British football. I was living in South Africa, okay. We all watched British football, and I chose Liverpool as my team for some reason. Who knows why you choose a specific team when you're living down there, right? And then, but then on Sundays, I used to watch the highlights packages, because that's what all we could see down there, is watch the highlights packages. I watched all these, and it was always like exciting to watch these highlight packages. And then when I was 18, I moved to the UK. Mm-hmm. And for the first time ever, then I watched a full game of Liverpool playing against some other team, Aston Villa or something like that, I think. And it was a 0-0 draw after 90 minutes, and it was just so boring. And so I was shocked at how boring the sport was, that I'd be like spending my whole childhood like being like, oh, you know, having like, wow, this is so important, and talking to my friends about it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'd never gone to the source. I'd never actually seen a game, right? Mm. And so... So yeah, just that important. So I actually wrote an article, I think about 3 years ago or two years ago, on our website, called Finding Your Urfather, which is kind of like a little bit of a metaphor of whatever it is that you think is important for your life, like go down into the roots of it and really get to know it, like intimately and on a deeper level than just the intellectual knowing as well. And I think
Because kind of, you know, to pull from that example, yours shows that it could be different than what we think it is, both for good or for worse, in the sense of, all right, if you think something's important to your life, like go down that rabbit hole, and maybe you'll realize sooner rather than later, which would be beneficial, that it's not. Mm-hmm. Or on the contrary, maybe you have an idea that something's meaningful towards you in your life, and you go down that rabbit hole and you realize that it is infinitely more meaningful than you ever could have realized. Yeah. And then, you know, that's why you continue to pursue it. That's, in my experience, been what classical music has been to me, you know, something that I started out with knowing, all right, like, I know there's value in this, but then just diving into the world and discovering a pantheon of greats and an endless supply of beauty that I can turn to and continue to get out of, like get so much value out of it. That's really, really impacted how I go about my day to day. And it's, you know, a positive example of what you just shared.
Yeah. And I think has given you an ability to discern music in a way that is beyond other people because you've been able to really ignite your passion. So I watched the video that's on your channel. I think it's something like why pop music is like pornography or something like that.
Yeah, pop is porn.
And pop is porn, yeah. And it's changed the way that I hear pop music today because like there's some truth that there's a real truth that you touched on there. And I think so. That was a little plug there too for anybody who's interested in getting an example of that, I think is worthwhile. We agree that we're going to try on this talk, and I guess this is like the main thing that we want to do here on this episode is to dive into a little rabbit hole for ourselves and our own work as well, right? Because you have this you call your project Rewire the West, and mm-hmm. I'm talking about restoring masculinity very much in, you know, Western civilization, that at least mainly Northern Europe that I'm working with, a little part of that than just the West, we've touched on a little bit. We haven't really opened up the can of worms yet. So when did the West get unwired? And where did things go wrong? So we know, like, you know, if we need to fix things again, then like, where do we need to go back to? So
awesome.
You want to start us off on that one?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and kick us off. Now, I know that knowing your background, you'll probably reach back a little bit further than I would. And I'm really interested to hear that perspective, actually. Where I am going to begin it with is William of Ockham in the mid 1200s. Okay. So this man, he lived throughout the turn of the century, from the 13th to 14th century. But writing in the late 1200s, he introduces the concept of nominalism. And now, of course, simplifying this a little bit, no philosophical concept can just be pinned on one guy, but more than anyone else up to that point, he makes this concrete. And nominalism, in its simplest sense, is the idea that no universals exist, that what we call something collectively, for example, humanity, is just one concept, that doesn't actually exist. There's only the individual experiences of people or the individual things, and that any universal is mistaken because it's just not real. Mm-hmm. And what this plays out into, this sets off a chain reaction, basically, that starts to take place over the next couple hundred years and ultimately leads us to where we are now. And now, I am not a fan of nominalism for reasons that I'll get into shortly. Mm-hmm. But what is remarkable is the degree to which you and I both are de facto nominalists. Like, just by virtue of being born in the culture that we were born in, when we were born here, we are de facto nominalists. It's the de facto point of view in which we view the world. And so let's get into like
an example of how we can see that, Mike.
Yeah. So I'll go to an example from Shakespeare, actually, and say why this is something that you or I would probably agree with right off the bat. Okay. The biggest example of nominalism in Shakespeare, and he's really interesting too, because fast forward to his time, so the turn of the 17th century, you know, 1500s going into the 1600s, he in Elizabethan culture has his finger on this. He's seeing nominalism introduce itself into the culture for better or for worse at different times, okay? Mm-hmm. Usually for worse. But where he shows this in full display is in the balcony scene of Romeo and Juliet. All right. So it's Juliet saying, "Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?" Okay. And for anyone who, you know, needs a clarification, wherefore means why. It does not mean where. So she's saying, "Romeo, why are you Romeo?" And she goes on to say, "A rose by any other name would smell as sweet." Okay, so she's basically saying, you know, I'm Juliet Capulet, you're Romeo Montague. Why do you have to have that last name? Because if you didn't have that last name, then, you know, we could be together, basically. A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. That is nominalist because it's saying that, all right, like, a rose, yes, we could call it anything, it'd still be the same. And the thing is, you or I immediately, like, we hear that and we agree with it. It sounds right. I don't know about you. I mean, at least I do, at the very least. It sounds right. Well, of course we could call it.
Yeah. The name doesn't mean anything. Like, when I asked my parents, why did you call me Paul? They're just like, oh, it just felt like a good name to call you. Like, you know, they didn't really think it's from the Bible, but like there was no deeper reflection about an inherent meaning in the name. It, exactly. It was just a word that they chose.
Exactly. And so basically it's this idea that, well, what we have, it doesn't, you know, there's no deeper meaning in it. And she basically says, like, she's saying, well, you could come from a different family, a different culture, you'd still be yourself. No, it's not like everything too. And what Shakespeare is pointing out here, and what I think people at his time would have recognized, is that Romeo and Juliet, they're interesting as a couple, because Shakespeare draws our sympathies towards them. You know, we're inclined to like them, but he also points out that there's a lot of flawed reasoning going into this. In a way that people at the time especially would have keyed into. So you can't just change your last name and be the same person. Who you are and the family you come from and who your father is, that changes you to an incredible degree. You cannot simply change that. In on a linguistic level, you know, maybe building off the example of the rose, you cannot simply say that, okay, this word is now going to mean something else. Mm-hmm. Okay. It is not in the sense like language, yes, can evolve. Okay. Yes, it changes over time. But in today's society, we have people who are incredible nominalists saying that we can just take words now and redefine them to mean whatever we want. You know, they treat language as currency, saying that, okay, currency inherently has no value. We only give it value because it's what we've collectively agreed upon to trust. Yeah. Well, with language, there is some truth in that, but there's more truth in the etymological roots of things. I can't wake up one day and decide that one certain word, I'm just going to completely change the meaning to mean the exact opposite. It doesn't work like that. But to many people today, it is the same thing. And so anyways, if I can kind of continue this, because I don't want to get bogged down there. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm doing a good job explaining it. But basically,
man and woman are very good words, like, or just the idea of gender and sex. And the confusion that's happening around there because of this. This is basically, I mean, nominalism, I would say there's a bit of Gnosticism that gets in there as well. Mm. Then. So it's like a double think kind of thing, that then suddenly there is a universal, but it has no connection to physical reality, exactly. Which is just basically, it's my feelings that then become the replacement.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, everything in the gender ideology of what's going on today is rooted in nominalism. Mm-hmm. It's the sense that there is no universal masculine or feminine. It's just kind of whatever I feel personally, you know. But to fast forward a little bit more into where this really starts in, you know, unwiring the West or whatever, however you want to phrase that, yeah, is you take these nominalist concepts and they actually seep into the Protestant Reformation in big ways. And part of how this happens is that they seep in through it in desacralizing important aspects of the church and religion. Okay, so in Catholicism, you have seven sacraments. In Protestantism, you have two, all right? And what they're basically saying is they're desacralizing these aspects of life. I'm going to take one sacrament from the Catholic Church, which is marriage, okay? So you take marriage as a sacrament, and then which is more or less.
Maybe you could just explain what you mean by the word sacrament.
Yeah. So it's a, with that. It's basically a turning point. I want to, like, a point of inflection in one's life that is imbued by the mediation of grace through an institution. All right. This is
that was a good Catholic description.
Yeah.
We didn't mention this at the beginning. You're a Catholic. I'm an Eastern Orthodox. I think Eastern Orthodox definition is just like, these are the mysteries of God. And mystery, it doesn't mean that it's like kind of, Yeah, it means that it's a mystery is something that's like beyond our rational explanation. That's kind of where we stop, I think, more than anything else. But
okay, I'm gonna try to get at with this, and I'm, you know, I'm no Catholic theologian, so please have mercy on me if anyone's listening to this. But basically, it's something that happens in a communal sense, in that occurs in an inflection point in life, like communion, baptism, marriage, and you enter into something in which grace is administered by the institution of the church in front of an entire community that transforms what you have into something higher. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now the reason this is important is because let's say that we know marriage is special. Okay. And when two people come together in Catholic marriage, for example, under the union of God, they're blessed by the church in the presence of community, which elevates their matrimony into something, you know, holy matrimony. Like it makes it set apart and different and special. Yeah. Now, when you desacralize that, all right, what happens is, and what happened, by the way, is that you run the risk of falling into one of two categories, all right? On one sense, you have to maintain the authority of marriage, but you can't do that through the mediation of grace through an institution, okay, through a revered cultural institution. What you now have to do is, if you're going to try to do that, you could run the risk of falling into patriarchal norms, okay, from more like Greco-Roman society. Mm-hmm. And this is specifically what happened in particular in English society at the time. Okay. So in the Protestant Reformation, basically when that hit the English shores, what happened was this marriage is desacralized. And then all of a sudden marriage diverted to, specifically among the upper classes, diverted to more patriarchal norms and means. And this
was basically the cause of the British Reformation, was that the British king wanted to divorce his wife and get a new one. The Pope had said no. So he was like, okay, screw you. I'm going to just take over myself as well. So it was, as you said, like it was a guy in power who then decided, well, I'm just going to make the rules up according to what suits me instead of what's always been, you know, what suits everybody else, or you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the whole point of like why it slips into these more patriarchal default norms is because you don't have now anything that is pre-existing giving it value. You have to create that value for yourself. And so you say, well, let's create this cultural institution of patriarchal power going down. Mm-hmm. And that's one extreme to where it can slide to. The other one, though, is that it becomes completely individualistic, all right? And it's people saying, well, I don't need a cultural institution to tell me, you know, what this is. Now marriage is just, again, it's how I feel inside. Like I can be married to you because of this union. And so actually in Shakespeare's time, when he's writing, he's seeing this happens, which is essentially you have the bourgeois class. As marriage is desacralized, they lean towards something more patriarchal, because it also, because of land rights and all this stuff, like it benefits them. Okay. But the upper middle class and the rising commercial class, the merchant class, what they do is they actually switch it the other way to say, well, marriage is what we feel inside, you know, and it's how like we want to marry other people. And it doesn't matter if there's no community feedback, if there's not as much, you know, administering of this grace by a cultural institution. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's kind of what we decide on. And now this, of course, like these are both extremes, and the church served to mediate these and to find a middle point of sorts. But when it's desacralized, you either have this patriarchal extreme, which it slipped into for a bit, or this hard individualist one, which is by and far where we are now, to where marriage is nothing more for most people than a sheet of paper. It's nothing more than, oh, well, like, you know, I love this person. I've taken a commitment to be with them. This is what marriage is. And it's nothing de facto higher. And so basically those two extremes open up, and it slides ultimately into this drastically individualist one, where any sort of, you know, reverence of the institution itself or regard for it, or even ideas that, all right, we should hear, you know, our community's feedback, our family's feedback, whatever this is, and consider that at the very least. It just completely goes out the window. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, for all this, kind of consider this a long rant on nominalism, but it ends up in one of these two places.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Orthodox marriage ceremony, you're actually crowned. That's the central part. The Western marriage ceremony, the most central part is when you say, I do. And that's because, as you said, it's a sheet of paper that's important. It's a legal agreement. And therefore, the explicit stating of I do is the central part of the ceremony because it's this legal thing. But in the Orthodox ceremony, it's actually the placing of the crown upon a head, which is a victor's crown and also a martyr's crown as well. Because what's happening is that you have kind of marriage is seen as, you know, the joining of two human beings. It's a step towards, you know, of love being instituted. It's how life is then created in the most stable, you know, any scientific study will tell you, like, children born inside a marriage and with a stable mother and father, family unit. You know, I'm a big believer in bigger extended families as well. I think the nuclear family can be dangerous, but I think it's a very, very good, very powerful unit as well. But the master's crown is very much about what you are is dying in that moment, actually. Mm. Something else is reborn. And that's happening in a very deep mystical level that is beyond our understanding. And if one just says, well, whatever, that's silly, stupid superstition, then obviously it's not going to have that much effect. But if you go into that ceremony, and I think pretty much anybody can understand that, doesn't matter whatever your beliefs are, if you go into that ceremony saying, okay, I'm putting on this crown as a martyr, you know, martyr is a witness to truth. that's what the word means. And so, and the witness dies and then something else is reborn. And so that's a very beautiful image to go into a lifelong relationship with another human being which is about, like, you know, being able to create more love in the world eventually, you know, because if you go into the marriage with just like, okay, well, I need a legal agreement to make sure my rights are looked after and that I can realize my goals in life or something like that, which is the institutional framework that has the Western idea of marriage has become today.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very bad institutional framework.
Yeah. And I think you're spot on with that. And just to kind of build on what I said earlier, because I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole with, you know, how nominalism has ultimately impacted things like marriage.
I want to say something about something you said earlier as well. I have a little disagreement point.
But okay, cool. Well, real quick on this part. Yeah. What you have in the Protestant Reformation, which a lot of Luther's thought was undergirded by ideas of nominalism, is that you are desacralizing not just things like the sacraments, but you are desacralizing everyday life, because in a sense, you know, marriage is one step of everyday life, but you're imbuing it with a sacred nature. And so once you desacralize these things, once you say, for example, a church is not a holy, like, this is one of the worst things of the Protestant Reformation. And I can't even stand to walk into some Protestant churches today because it's not even a church. It's a freaking warehouse, you know? And they just say, oh, well, we can worship God anywhere. It's like, yeah, on surface level, that's true. But you're in a freaking warehouse, man. Like, go into a Catholic cathedral here in Europe and it's gorgeous. It actually feels like a place where God resides. And so it's an architectural place that you have made sacred. And we have these places in our life, you know, whether it be an actual venue of worship or simply the home, you know, marriage or a place of, you know, labor, you know, kids growing up, whatever they are, that are sacred. In nominalism, what it results in is ultimately the desacralization of these things, to where we can get to the point where we say, we echo Juliet in saying, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Marriage is just, it's simply this piece of paper. It's nothing else. And that's the danger undergirding it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So actually I had two little things that I wanted to dig a little bit more into. I think the first one might be quite short, and that's just like, I didn't really like your use of the word patriarchy, because you spoke about how we could go in these two different directions towards the kind of like individualist or the patriarchal. Orthodoxy is a patriarchal system. It's a patriarchal religion. It's run by patriarchs. They're called patriarchs, actually. The Catholic Church, of course, has just one patriarch, which is the Pope. I think that there's a tendency for us to see the word patriarchy as meaning tyranny. And what I heard,
well, you I very much do not.
Yeah.
And I don't use it like, I know how I said it. It's funny you mention this, because I actually thought this while I was saying it. Mm-hmm. Is that it sounded like for a minute I was just like, oh, the patriarchy. Like, it's not that at all. I said the patriarchy in the Greco-Roman sense, yeah, okay, which is that it is a system that it has to build authority on itself. Patriarchy in a more Christian sense, or in the way that, you know, simply recognizing like a difference in gifts and disposition and in roles in a hierarchical system, that is not wrong. What is wrong is when you step into like just a system without any rhyme or reason to it. You know, I have no qualms at all with the Orthodox system, with the Catholic system, of course, which in by some definitions are, you know, patriarchal. But all I mean is that
I would say that like just patriarchy seems to be more or less written into the fabric of reality, like in the kind of male, female, you know, differences of being. We there are examples of matriarchal societies, but they're very, very few and far between. Societies generally tend towards being patriarchal, and that's just the way it is, you know, Christian, pagan, whatever. So for me, it's like, well, patriarchy is actually neutral. It's a description of reality. There's also matriarchy in reality, which is good and important and not bad either. It's just that like the dominant power structures in almost all human civilizations have been patriarchal. That's, you know, and then there's been matriarchal parts of that as well. And, you know, the matriarch and the patriarchy need to work together to create a flourishing society, you know, but it's the problem turns if you suddenly see those things as opposed to each other, which I think is that's the source of a lot of our problem today, is that we see like, oh, patriarchy somehow opposed to matriarchy or to a flourishing society. It's like, well, then you just have gender war, which is,
well, I don't, and forgive me if I'm using like the wrong terminology, I don't disagree with any of what you're saying.
No,
like
I agree,
I don't use patriarchy in a bad, like, I basically what I'm trying to get at, or what I was trying to get at, maybe I'm using the wrong word, but like marriage, when it was desacralized, it lost the power inherent in it. It lost its inherent authority. Mm-hmm. And so it slipped back to in you know, the Catholic Church, for example, which is where I said it got desacralized from, it is inherently patriarchal. Yeah. But what it turned to was it because it lost that endowment from the church, it had to rely on something that was either a false authoritarianism, mm-hmm, in the sense of like just in distribution of power for power's sake, or an individualist model where the people take that power instead of
I think we completely agree even on that one. So spot on. I reacted to the word. So
That's fine. I hope people listening to this get what I'm, you know, trying to get at.
The other thing I wanted to do was to go right back to the beginning of your story. And that's that William of Ockham.
Yeah.
Occam's razor, I was confusing it with.
No, I mean, that is him.
He came up with that one. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
his so razor.
The question I had is, you know, it's easy for you and me as two guys who kind of share a worldview more or less, or have a very large overlap, to kind of like say like, oh yeah, that guy was wrong and bad and everything that came from was all bad. But probably he was a really intelligent guy as well.
Yeah.
And probably there was a problem that he was trying to solve. And with all of his, you know, best possible intention and virtue that he could muster, was trying to solve some kind of problem or challenge. I don't know him very well. I know a little bit about him. And I have an idea of what he was trying to solve. But I'm wondering if you have, like, so, was there some value in what he was trying to do? Yeah. And he just went too far. Was this? Yeah.
So these nominalist ideas, all, or any kind of thing that goes against, you know, what you or I would advocate for, what it comes out, or what it is rooted from, if I can say it that way, is seeing authority, the appearance of authority arbitrarily applied, if that makes sense. So it's a frustration, and sometimes rightfully so, with authority in rule in a society seeming just to be completely arbitrary and not having, you know, not being administered just with justice, if that makes sense. So I guess, yeah. Give me a sec to try to kind of collect my thoughts on this, because you're right that he was pointing out something. Okay, like if I can go back to this marriage example, basically, the desacralization of it actually sped up the decree of individualism, because I told you it was in this framework that was sacralized, okay, by the church, and still patriarchal, okay, but what in a healthy sense, but what it evolves into is, again, what I said, an arbitrary like relapse in the bourgeois class of England onto these Greco-Roman ideas of what marriage was. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the populace, the rising merchant class at the time, saw this as arbitrary. They said, now you're no longer sanctified by the church. Now you're just coming up with stuff because that's how you want to do it. And so if you're doing that, because they saw this as arbitrary, what they're saying is, well, why can't we just say for ourselves that this is what it is? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
so they saw something. So actually, like, you know, in relying on something more strict, it broke easier. It's kind of like vinyl records. This is a silly example, but vinyl records use, when they first started being made, they were made with very hard plastic, and they would break a lot of the time in transport. And they would break actually because the plastic was too hard. It was too rigid. So what they started to do was to make it with a softer plastic that you could bend more easily. Like if you take a record today, you can bend it back and forth pretty well. What you realize is when you have some bend there, it's less likely to break. Mm-hmm. And so basically the introduction of like nominalism and is saying, well, we're seeing this administration of authority that seems arbitrary. Okay. So we're going to react to it. And then that speeds it up, because then unless you can offer a robust defense of why this is done the way it's done, then it will feel arbitrary. And then that will speed up the you know, spread of nominalism into that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. And I think a very practical sense, you can bring it to any person in any kind of leadership or authority position in an organization today. It's like, if you are administering rules and implementing them according to your own preferences, then you're going to awaken this sense of arbitrary injustice with everybody who that's influencing.
That's
going to cause things to break apart, right?
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Because let's take something that can be arbitrary but meaningful. Let's say there's like a code of, you know, a code of 12 principles at work, at your office. They just decide randomly on this one day, okay? And now if a higher up breaks one of those rules, that is arbitrary, by the way, but if they break it and then they are enforced, like it is enforced against them, the punishment or whatever the justice is, then people will think that it's fair and they'll go along with it, even though it's, you know, on a surface.
And it will even raise those rules a little bit more upwards towards the sacred, because then they're suddenly higher than the boss as well.
Exactly.
So that's what sacredness is about, right? People think sacred, oh, it means that it's all this mystical, weird and wonderful stuff. It's like, no, these are just like principles that have stood the test of time and shown that they can support human flourishing over a long period of time. You know, that's one way of looking at it, right? That's the bottom up way.
And so that would be the positive example, where you come up with something like, let's just say, all right, there's 12 rules, whatever. We could write them on a sheet of paper, completely like make them up. But if we enforce them non-arbitrarily to everyone, then everyone will start to see them as fair and it will make sense. However, if one of the guys at the top breaks the rules and then it's not enforced, then everyone else will say, well, what the heck? This is arbitrary. Like, who made these rules in the first place? Why do we have to follow them and you don't? I mean, you just wrote them on a sheet of paper, for Pete's sake, you know? That's what they're going to start saying. And so I think that is where, like, in terms of the development of ideas, that is where nominalism stems from, is seeing authority seemingly arbitrarily administered.
It's
the perception of that, but then it plays out to something.
This is the perfect example that's going to play exactly into what I was wanting to put forward. So
okay, go ahead.
So that I think that's really interesting. So you kind of hinted that I might go back just a little bit further.
Yeah.
And the year that I'll point to start off with is 1054, which is the year of the Great Schism, which is when the Orthodox and the Catholic Church split off from each other, and there were several issues that had their roots far further back, of course, that had, you know, been already causing a very large cultural and informal divide, you know, language divide. There was the Latins and the Greeks and all kinds of different elements of and cultural things. But at the end of the day, I think that what really made the difference was that in Rome, there was this idea that the Patriarch of Rome, the Pope, is the sole authority of the church. He can speak from the throne of Peter. And so what he says is, you know, basically his word is law kind of thing. And he can unilaterally make decisions, which are then authoritative for all of the other patriarchs. Whereas the Orthodox position is that all of the different churches and all of the different cities each had a patriarch, and they were all in a conciliar manner, equals. And then Rome was seen as the first amongst equals. And historically, the Roman Pope had a record of also keeping to the straight and true in a way that some of the other patriarchs didn't. They kind of, you know, they got further pulled off by some of the heresies such as Arianism and monothelitism and stuff like that as well. Whereas it seemed like Rome was better at keeping that. So there was also a kind of moral authority based on that for a long time as well. But then the official kind of split and schism happened when Rome said, you know, you guys submit and do as we tell you, or we're going to excommunicate all of you. and the specific difference, which I won't dig into here, but there's a very deep theological difference in this as well, is on the Christian creed, which came from the Council of Nicaea.
Proceeds from the Father and the Son.
Yeah. So it's called the Filioque, which is basically, I think it was in the churches under Charlemagne where they started using this extra little sentence. Mm-hmm. Originally, the first recording we have it is used in Spain. Then Charlemagne takes it up and starts talking about the Holy Spirit as proceeding from the Father and the Son. Whereas the original creed, it just says he proceeds from the Father as well. And then the Pope also decides at some point that he wants to add in this Filioque as well. It doesn't get agreed on at a church council, which is where the creed is originally decided. And so the Pope tries to push it through unilaterally. The Eastern churches reject this. And so then the split happens. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways of looking at this, but one of the things that just, I haven't actually heard anyone else speaking about this, but it seems so obvious to me is that when you have one person leading, then there's kind of like a concentration of power and authority in the head, and the body is kind of deprioritized to a certain extent. And so you kind of like, you know, you center a lot of decision-making ability in at the very top of the organization, and that can create a lot of power to be very dynamic and fast and aggressive and also make very clear decisions, and also to, in some cases, you know, yeah, do things some well, but it also means you lose out on some of the multiplicity that's found in the body.
Yeah, well, I would, like, on that point, I'd push back a little bit, where I think that's a very modern conception of top-down authority, which is that we see it as being, again, this top-down, there's just one person at the top, so necessarily he's going to drive things that changes how everyone else works. But just a simple look at history in medieval Europe will show that actually in several, you know, monarchical kingdoms, what you have is the complete opposite, where, yes, there is one head, but they can still decentralize the command to allow different regions of their kingdom to operate very differently. I think this is, you know, case in point in France, where you know, the diversity in France, whether it be in the southeastern region or, you know, the western provinces, they would all operate very, very differently. Mm-hmm. And it would, the king basically gave authority to people under him to make decisions for themselves. And I actually think that, like, so it's possible to have one person who steers the ship. And this is what I would say in almost any organization is a positive. It's just, it's so hard to do well. But you can get to the point where there is one person who, if things can't be resolved, you know, it goes up to them. It's kind of like the Supreme Court, the way that the court system works in America, at least, is that you actually, it's very efficient. It's run well because you have these courts at the bottom levels who have the authority to make decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. And then at lower levels, you know, as they rise up, basically, they rise up.
That's Evan's wife. Congratulations. I think you got married not so long ago, right?
Thank you. Yes. So anyways, she just said, sorry, she didn't realize. Basically, like, you have these things at the bottom level going, and then they'll go up. All right, if this can't be decided, if it's appealed, it goes to this, and then it goes to this, and then it goes to, and then there's one court that makes a decision and puts in a premise that everyone's going to follow afterwards. But
I mean, in that example, the top court is a council, not an individual, right? That example you're using.
Yes, but you could still see it as like functioning in one person. That to me, it's one body that matters.
It's one body, and
to me that there's not much of a difference.
But yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you, even, and I also think that, like, you know, individual leadership has many, many good things about it, and and it doesn't contradict decentralized decision making and delegation, absolutely, and I think those are obviously incredibly good and powerful things. What I am saying, though, is there is a pattern here, if you're willing to look at the pattern. And the pattern is an over-concentration of power in the top, which leads to a rejection of that kind of that concentration in the body, which you start seeing the seeds of in nominalism, which, you know, was basically a rejection of, or a reaction against what was perceived as too much concentration of power. And then obviously had its, you know, kind of full result in the Protestant Reformation, where then there's an explosion of rejection of that authority. I'm not saying your Orthodox Church doesn't have its problems, but that's not the problem that the Orthodox Church has had, right? There hasn't been a nominalist movement in the Orthodox world. There hasn't been a Protestant Reformation in the Orthodox world. And I think that's a direct relate thing to, you know, the leadership of the Orthodox Church is much more messy. There's much more multiplicity in it. Yeah. But as a result, it also is able to integrate more. And then, you know, like, yes, we need one man up at the top to lead. But, you know, so the idea in Christianity is, well, that's Christ. Mm-hmm. And so that's firmly entrenched in the metaphysics of the church. And I know you guys will say, well, okay, you know, the Pope's just the representative of Christ. But obviously, he's going to do that job imperfectly, right? And we have lots of examples.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing, man. I think, like, inherently, I do not disagree at all with the structure, because I think it's not the structure itself. Having one person at the top is not inherently wrong. It's when that power is perceived to be administered arbitrarily. That is the point. And that, like, there's no getting around the fact that the Catholic Church went that route for quite a time. And actually, in one of Shakespeare's plays, he gets to the heart of this beautifully. It's in Richard II, okay? Where Richard II, he over-relies on his, you know, birthright as king, if you will. That's where he forgets the need to come across as a just ruler, and he only focuses on the fact of, well, this is my right, so I can do it, okay? He focuses on that, and he loses his kingship because of that. It goes to, eventually, Henry IV usurps. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly, like, it's a really great play, actually. Most people know Richard III instead of Richard II, but Richard II, it's all about that story of how that happens, how an over-reliance and a, like, basically abusing your position of authority leads to this specific outcome. And I'm not saying that that never happened in the church. Like, again, fundamentally, I don't disagree with the structure. I will disagree with how people administered it and used it as a trump card. You can't use it as a trump card. And I think that's the thing. You know, you only have to on the most pressing issues where a decision simply has to be made. Like, you have to cross the Rubicon one way or the other, but you can't use it to simply say, all right, well, here's my authority, you know, take it and shut up. You can't do that, or else it's not going to work. Then people will rebel against that. Yeah. But in organizations today, again, like, there's plenty of things where I've seen many, you know, people work well. Again, it's tough to pull off, but if you can do it, then it's more powerful ultimately than I think.
For most organizations, the right leadership structure, especially like a small one starting off, you need like just one guy who's able to make agile decisions, right? And then as you grow, you need more complexity. And then, you know, the Christian church is this ancient, you know, people forget, like, this is an organization that's lasted for 2,000 years. Like, it's very, very old. And it's more than a miracle that there are no other organizations that are that old, really, right? Yeah. Like, you know, that aren't like, you know, also just things get very dysfunctional the older they are. And so it's like, yes, we have had corruption and there's all kinds of issues in the church. Of course, like, there are no human organizations that are free of that kind of stuff. And if you know, there's always going to be stuff like that as well.
Yeah. And so, and I think it's just where reality hit, like, bumps up against an ideal, you know, on one level. I'd call myself a monarchist, of course, because the kingdom of God is a monarchy.
Love monarchy. Like, I'm a massive fan. I love it that I'm living in a monarchy, and I wish it was more monarchical, actually.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, like, ultimately, you know, God's kingdom is a monarchy. Okay. And if we take humanity to be created in the image of God, then ideally that is the best that we could strive towards. However, then we, of course, bump into the obvious, which is that humans are flawed. You know, humans have original sin and they're going to make decisions. So you're always going to have people who abuse that power, you know, who are at the top, who say, this is my authority, whether you like it or not. And I don't have to, you know, justify the reasons for doing this. So here's
another, I don't know, let's not take too long on this, because we're going to end up with just like Orthodox versus Catholic. Maybe that should be the title of this video. We'll see. But one last thing. So for me, the head of the church on earth, it's the mother of God, actually. Hmm. It's the mother of God. Like, she, you know, I see her very much as alive. Mm-hmm. It's a woman instead of a man. And, you know, the primary example that she set as a human being was her answer to the angel, you know, where she said, like, let it be done to me according to your word. Mm-hmm. So that is the example. It's a radical acceptance of the divine will in one's life, and to just live according to that, and to let one's life become dedicated to that, even though it included for her, you know, massive suffering of seeing her son being sacrificed on a cross, right? It was obviously a terrible thing to happen to your own child, your own son. But that's for me, like, that's for me what replaces the Pope, actually.
Hmm. Well, I mean, again, like, in theory, I don't have any qualms with that. I think it's just, look, like, there have to be people on the ground doing stuff. And I don't agree with their action. Like, you can look back and find plenty of bad popes, you know, Dante includes, I think,
and bad patriarchs, like terrible patriarchs. You
know, like, yeah. But at the end of the day, we have to have people on earth doing things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to say, like, well, Christ is the head of the church, or, you know, Mary is the queen of the church on earth. It's like, yes, that's true. But how are we deciding this one thing in the present?
Even are you going to give me the pattern? Do you see the pattern, like, that, like, nominalism is a natural result of having a single human leader as a pope? Like, the one thing causes the other. Like, the way the Orthodox
I just disagree with saying that it's inherently a result. I would say that it's only a result when that power is, you could even include inevitably in there, inevitably abused, but it is not the de facto result. You can't say that if you have this, then it's going to result in nominalism. That's what I don't agree with. Like, I don't think it's the de facto result of that. I think it's
the result that we've seen, and the pattern seems to be deepening throughout reality, throughout history. Like, it's the result that has happened. I mean, the Orthodox kind of say, like, you know, the way we see it is like Protestantism is the egg that the Roman Catholic chicken laid, that it naturally gave birth to. It's offspring in that way, like that. That's the kind of perspective.
Yeah, I guess just my perspective is like I say that it is very unfortunate that the church comported itself in this way that led to this, you know, awful repercussion. Basically, I don't see it as like from the get. What I don't see is that from the point we decided to have a pope, that this was just a ticking time bomb bound to happen. That's what I'm disagreeing with.
No, I don't believe in determinism either. Like, you know, the way things happen is a synergy between our actions and God's actions. And so I don't see it as a ticking time bomb either. No, it's there's free will and everybody has free will. And so things are not set up like, you know, pool balls on a billiard table.
Yeah. And I think the church just went, it pushed itself past the breaking point many times over. And so then it's like, it's our fault that we got the Protestant Reformation. I'll disagree with the fact that it was inevitable. Like, I won't say that it was inevitable. I'd say that.
I completely agree on that. Maybe I probably went too far if I said inevitable.
Anyways, we can move on from theology, although this has been
good. Yeah, okay. So, I mean, maybe we should have taken this beforehand, actually. But the other topic I wanted to get into was this guy, Jordan Peterson, because that's, I think, for me, as a scientifically educated, you know, kind of political scientist from Copenhagen University, where it's just like Foucault, Derrida, all of these guys, that was like the core of everything I learned about the way the world worked. Jordan Peterson is the guy who could take me and like talk in the language that exactly spoke into my whole worldview there, but say like, hey, you're missing out on something. And there's this whole thing of like everything about where you come from and the nature of reality that's described in the wisdom literature throughout all time. And you've kind of just like written it off very cheaply as having no value whatsoever. And if you just stop up and just for a little second, look at it a little bit more deeply, you'll realize that there's all kinds of depth and amazing value in there. And when I heard him saying that, I was like, oh, that kind of sounds reasonable. Maybe there's something about him that's right there. And so I did that. And then like, you know, that kind of led me to, I would say, not just totally revising my ideas about reality, but also being able to drastically shift the direction of my own life from one that I now see was very clearly going into a path of chaos and nihilism and destruction to today being one that is headed, you know, orientated towards beauty and truth and joy and the kinds of things that I got out of emails I get from even every Saturday afternoon.
First thing I'll say, just to kind of segue from that last conversation, is your de facto position was the result of nominalism. It was the result of saying these old books, they don't contain universals because universals don't exist. They are, this is what the university says, that they are basically the same value as everything else. That's why now, today, look this up. You can go to certain Ivy League schools, get a degree in English without having to study Shakespeare, without having to study the greatest author in the English language. You don't have to study it. It's insane.
I would put other guys in front of Shakespeare, but fine.
Okay, but still, like one of the, if not the greatest in the English
language. No, I agree. Like you need
to top three, and you don't have to study them. You know, like that's insane to me. But it's the result of nominalism. And so what Jordan hit on and what resonated with you was to say these books are not equal. Okay, they have shaped civilization for thousands of years for a reason, because they hit on universal truths. Yeah. Don't take that lightly. Go look into it. And you did, and look what happened. This is the result of, you know, going to things that have universal value, what beauty has. I think you hit the nail on the head with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so this is, I mean, I'm actually busily listening to John Vervaeke's lecture series, which is called mm-hmm. Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, where he dives into really much into the roots of a lot of these things. And he's doing it from a kind of secular mindfulness Buddhist perspective in some ways. But there's 95% of what he's saying, I completely agree with as well. And I think that there is a very large portion of the population who are, you know, it's not so much in the kind of academic elites, media elites, political elites, groups of people, but I think everywhere else, and certainly like, you know, out in the little countryside village where I am, then people are aware of this stuff and are more and more realizing like things are kind of going overboard right now. And we're getting a little derailed. This project's gone too far. Personally, what I believe, and this is again like a very anti-nominalist statement, and it's going to trigger a lot of people because it goes against the political agenda. But I'm not saying it in a political sense, and I'm trying to stay away from the politics of it. But I believe there's a need for men to step up and to take these things seriously and to understand them and to discuss them and to deepen their own understandings about it. That's what I believe. I don't exactly. You know, I can come with some kind of theory about why, but the most important thing is just like it needs to happen. And it's not like men, it's not like women shouldn't do it. You know, women are so welcome to do it. I love it when women do it as well. But the primary conversations right now seem to be happening between men.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's also just the way it's always been again. Like, you know, patriarchy has been written into but right now in our society, it seems like we're saying like, no, all of the most important conversations need to happen between women, and men need to step back. And it's like that's a fundamentally anti-reality perspective, I think. It's going against the natural way of things.
Yeah. And part of it is just how our men as individuals derive meaning and fulfillment, is that you have to contribute. I think this is part of the simple fact of like, maybe this sounds silly, but we can't give birth. And because of that, we have to almost like give birth to something else, to something that is an idea of ours or a realized goal, or, you know, bringing something to fruition. If you're made in the image of a creator, you are due to create. And part of this meaning crisis is perhaps because of the fact of men don't have anything bigger than them in which they can, you know, feed into to help it create. Because let's be realistic, like by ourselves, what we can contribute is actually fairly small. Like the amount of men out there who are able to create something all on their own is very, very small. Mm-hmm. It's tough to start a business. It's tough to, you know, have an entrepreneurial project, even something that's just content creation based. It's tough to do that. And not many people get the opportunity to. But what makes up for that, what has historically made up for that, are these cultural institutions. It's been in churches, for example, or even social clubs, you know, like having running groups that you can lead, that you can help other people achieve their goals. It was for a long time in the idea of even the nation. In the nation, not in a nationalistic sense, but as the extension of community. I always define country as this. Like people here, especially in Europe, nationalism, if you fly a flag, my gosh, you're a fascist. You know, that's what they immediately think of you. But nationalism is at the heart, it's an extension, or patriotism, maybe, if you want to call it this. Like it's an extension of love of community, because you start with a county, then you go to a state, then you go to whatever. Like it goes bigger. And so it's just community in a sense. And if you can, quote unquote, like die for your country, you're dying for an extended community. You're helping your extended community create something of good in the world. And so all this to say, like in Europe specifically, and this is, you know, it's coming to the US, but in Europe specifically, it was devastated by two world wars. And I don't think like the average person today does not have any degree of the how drastic this was. Where after the war, almost everything for men was thrown by the wayside. These opportunities to create meaning, to partake in something, if they couldn't create something themselves, to partake in something that was creating something else. because the idea of contributing to the good of a nation completely out the window, because you could not touch that. Okay. The idea of religion, well, almost decimated, you know, because of the rise of secularism and also just, you know, the history of the church in Europe, what it's led to, completely disappeared. Communities and even workplaces, they've been atomized. People in Europe are insanely atomized. Part of it's cultural, part of it's societal in terms of how like society is structured. But basically these opportunities for men to go and create meaning have completely fallen by the wayside. So it's no wonder, you know, that it's hard for young men today, even older men, to find meaning, because these opportunities to partake in something that allows you to create, to do good in the world, they've just completely disappeared, seemingly so.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, one of the things I've been really inspired by, I think I first heard it in conversations between Jonathan Peugeot and J.P. Marceau. He had some conversations, and they talk about like the stretching out of hierarchies between the individual and the state. And that very much facilitated by technology as well. And so the natural way for human beings to be is to be embedded in very complex, multi-level hierarchical structures, which are linked to each other and cascade from, you know, the sub-individual level as well, through individuals to families and wider extended families and local communities, through associations and organizations, and, you know, organized around, you know, spiritual practices, organized around activities, organized around, you know, shared beliefs and that kind of thing, and then having multiple levels of that up into, you know, the state, and then even interstately organizations, right? And what we're seeing, and you know, this has been radically accelerated by Corona in the last couple of years as well, right? As you've seen almost a massive devastation of this kind of thing. You know, I've been thinking, just living out to the countryside here, I can also really see how just like the impact of the car, what that's done as well to local communities. It's crazy. Here where I'm living here, they want to build a bridge now across from the mainland across to this island, very close to where we live. And if they build it, there's going to be 17,000 cars a day coming through there. And it's going to radically transform this, like, you know, it's one of the most beautiful natural areas in the whole of Denmark. It's called the South Danish Alps. It's very hilly, in our small little hills. When I first came here, I was like, well, okay, yeah, well, of course, if they want to build a bridge and it make everybody have a shorter distance, then, you know, like, yeah, you know, why should everybody be looking after those cars, have to drive somewhere, right? But more and more after I've been living here, I've come to this point where I'm like, no, screw that bridge. I don't want them. Yeah. I wouldn't want a bridge here. And very much based on, like, you know, it is this chase after efficiency and optimization and making things faster and easier and shorter that's actually a part of what's driving the flattening of culture and the loss of beauty. We think that what we want is just things to be more efficient, more fast, so we could get to our destinations faster. But like, it's just, that's not what life is about, actually.
No, you're spot on. And the reason, like, again, just to bring this full circle, incorporating all of what we've spoken about, the reason we have that perspective is because we're anomalous. And that resulted in the desacralization of everyday life. Before, you would have recognized that there was something sacred in the local community, in what you had, and there not being traffic. And so you would never think to impede it. But because it's been desacralized, well, the only logical answer basically is, well, of course, dude, because why would you not be more efficient? You don't even stop to ask the question. That's the whole thing.
You order a report from Deloitte, who work out all the financial, environmental, and social impacts of building a bridge, and they create nice little tables and graphs and reports and have scientists sign it all off, and they say, oh yeah, everything's great, let's just go ahead and do it, basically, right? And there'll be a couple of people down there, these old people in this little towns who are dissatisfied, and like, yeah, we'll give them some money and then they'll be happy.
No, it's because everything's been desacralized. There are things in life more important than money. You can't just pay something off, like dignity, honor, peace, tranquility, whatever it may be. There are certain things that money can't buy and it shouldn't buy.
And so this idea, I think let's make that the title of this talk, even, is everything is sacred or something like that, because that's the realization that people need to come back to. I think if people take anything from this talk, it's like, starting to notice how life is not, you know, and I think it's the commercialization that's kind of pushing this, the commercialized individualist consumer. A lot of what we're doing every single day is, and the way it works is by making things profane instead of sacred, which is their natural state is
absolutely
with spirit.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Good deal. Well, I've enjoyed this conversation. I think that's a good place to end up.
Yeah. Great. Thanks very much, Evan. Yeah. Good one. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Take care.
Yeah.
Bye.
You've been listening to Conversations on Masculinity with Manifesto. We enjoy good discussions, but far more importantly, we are a real community with plenty of opportunities for you to engage online and in person. So check out our website on manifesto.com to learn more. And if you enjoyed the content here, then please share this podcast with a friend. Thanks.